spectacle of chain metal and pyrotechnics, featuring a fleet of jeeps, dune buggies, and motorcycles kicking up dust at high speed. A match to gasoline. Some of Tupac's associates didn't gel with Suge's associates. During a stay in the New York City area for a February 17, 1996, Saturday Night Live appearance, Suge decided to mess with Tupac's assistants. According to Reggie Wright Jr., Suge and his homeboys told Tupac's guys to run out in the snow, take their clothes off, I think they were in their boxers, and throw up snowballs in the air. When they did as ordered, Suge said it confirmed they were weak and could be easily gotten to, and therefore should be replaced, according to Wright, adding that they were subsequently no longer part of the camp. For reasons such as these, some have argued that Suge changed Tupac. Did he give the formerly conscious rapper a taste for blood? The reverse may be closer to the truth. Tupac changed Suge. Sure, Suge had long been a bully, but Tupac brought out something more frightening in him. He was enabling Suge to think he was invincible, wrote Stormy Ramdan, who has two children with Suge in her memoir. Everyone started to notice this new Suge. He was more direct, a bit colder, harder to get a hold of, and less about his business. Suge did not make Pac more aggressive, said Edie Amin, but the two of them together was like lighting the match to a can of gasoline. Not everyone heeded the battle call. When Tupac asked the Lady of Rage to diss female New York rappers Lil' Kim and Foxy Brown, she declined. Even Snoop, despite stomping on skyscrapers in the Dog Pound video, failed to get on board with Tupac's war. In a New York radio station interview in September 1996, he declared his love for Puffy and Biggie, angering Tupac. On their flight home, Snoop said he worried for his life, since he was surrounded by Tupac and people loyal to him. Suge didn't let none of my security ride with me, he told the journalist Sway in 2013, adding that he slept nervously under a blanket at the back of the private plane, clutching a knife and fork in case he was attacked. Tupac found willing allies in the Outlaws, a group of New York and New Jersey teenagers and early 20-somethings. Their ranks included one of Tupac's cousins, his stepbrother Mo Preem, as well as fearsome street-certified childhood friends and friends of friends, whom he considered family. We always kept guns on us. Every single fucking day, Outlaws member Young Noble told me, adding that they were ready to defend Pac at any cost. We was some young warriors. To drive home the point, Tupac named many of them for famous dictators: Gaddafi, Hussein Fadel, Castro, Napoleon. Most Outlaws members weren't established rappers, but following Tupac's release from prison, they switched coasts and moved into his home, driving around a soccer mom-style Dodge Caravan harboring the camp's weed and guns, which they called the Murder Van. They trailed Tupac's Rolls Royce from one spot to the next, giving him cover in case he was pulled over. They rolled his blunts, they rapped on his songs, they got outlaw tattoos. They were ready to follow him to the gates of hell. At the March 1996 Soul Train Awards, held at the Shrine Auditorium near the University of Southern California, Biggie's One More Chance won for Best R&B or Rap Song. He took the stage with his entourage, and the scattered boos grew louder when he shouted out, "Brooklyn." Bad Boy enlisted Crips for protection that night. After the show, their party awaited their car outside when a black Hummer pulled up. Tupac rolled down his window, and he and Biggie came face to face for the first time since the Quad Studio shooting.
"Westside, fuck y'all,"
yelled Tupac, flanked by Suge and Death Row Bloods, one of whom yelled,
"Let's settle this now."
Guns were drawn on both sides.
"That was the first time I really looked into his face. I looked into his eyes and I was like, yo, this nigga is really bugging the fuck out.
Biggie said. Nation of Islam members quickly stepped in, acting as human shields between the two camps. No one was harmed. But Biggie couldn't help but observe that his former friend Tupac had taken on the persona of his Juice character.
I was like, that's Bishop.
Death Row Style. Upon its early 1996 release, All Eyes on Me was a sensation. Fueled by California love, Tupac's omnipotence in the news, and Death Row's secret sauce, the album was a juggernaut, becoming one of only a handful of diamond platinum albums, 10 million sold, in rap history. Tupac was on Interscope the whole time, Suge Knight bragged. They couldn't make him a superstar. But the minute I got Pac out of prison... Basking in the success, Tupac felt momentum in his battle against Biggie.
Nigga shot me 5 times,
he said, while performing at the House of Blues.
I fucked his bitch and sold 5 million. That's Death Row Style.
He soon recorded the most searing and bombastic diss song of all time, Hit 'Em Up, a track that knocked anyone who heard it back on their heels. Produced by Johnny J, its bouncy, jubilant beat betrays the venom within. It samples Biggie and his affiliated group Junior Mafia's Get Money, while its chorus, Grab Your Glocks When You See Tupac, echoes another Junior Mafia and Biggie song, Player's Anthem, which goes, Grab Your Dick If You Love Hip-Hop. Lyrically, Tupac's goal was to make the track as personal as possible, and at the song's onset, he immediately goes for the jugular.
That's why I fucked your bitch, you fat motherfucker.
He quickly expands the scope of his wrath beyond Biggie to Lil' Kim and anyone at all who identifies with Bad Boy. Tupac's Outlaws crew members, Hussein Fatal, Gaddafi, and Idi Amin, take shots at Junior Mafia. In the song's video, the crew gesticulates shirtless and peers imposingly down into the camera. Idi Amin said they sought to top classic diss tracks like The Bridge Is Over and No Vaseline. And indeed, the song eclipses them both in its pure molten bellicosity. As the track fades out, Tupac all but loses it.
Fuck you, die slow, motherfucker! My 44 makes sure y'all kids don't grow!
The message was heard. The day this song dropped, New York was quiet.
Like we had got punched in our collective chests, said longtime New York hip-hop insider Combat Jack.
Plain and simple, the record was hot, and the rage that jumped from off the track was very disconcerting. Biggie said he didn't believe his wife had cheated. If she had, Tupac never would have talked about her that way.
If honey was to give you that pussy, why would you disrespect her like that? He said.
He even made light of the situation on Brooklyn's Finest, his duet with his protege Jay-Z.
If Faye has twins, she'll probably have 2 Pacs.
In October 1996, Faith gave birth to a healthy boy, Christopher Jordan Wallace. Publicly, the Bad Boy contingent put on a brave face, again trying both not to escalate things and also not appear weak.
What it's been right now is a lot of movie making and a lot of entertainment drama, Puffy said. Bad Boys move in silence. If somebody wants to get your ass, you're gonna wake up in heaven. There ain't no record gonna be made about it.
Bow Down. In its early days, many New York rap fans saw Los Angeles hip-hop as a corny knockoff. For their part, L.A. artists often felt shut out by New York radio station programmers, record shop owners, and disc jockeys who wouldn't traffic their music. K-Day DJ Russ Parr, who performed as his satirical alter ego, Bobby Jimmy, said he got the cold shoulder in 1986 when he performed in the Big Apple.
I made the mistake of saying I was from L.A.
To them, no one west of the Hudson River had the right to rap. In unison, they all turned their backs on me.
It was like it was planned. This was perhaps understandable before acts like NWA kicked things into gear. But by the mid-90s, the West Coast was dominant. After Straight Outta Compton, America's Most Wanted, The Chronic, and Black Sunday, doubting the potency of L.A.'s movement was laughable. Even Def Jam, perhaps rap's most iconic label, chased trends on the other side of the country in the early 90s with its Def Jam West sub-imprint. Still, some L.A. rappers felt disrespected. None more so than Ice Cube, who for this reason decided to insert himself into the East Coast-West Coast beef. "I threw myself in the middle of it," he admitted. It was an odd turn of events, considering that at the dawn of the 90s, owing to his collaborations with Public Enemy and the Bomb Squad, Cube was perhaps the West's biggest emissary to the East Coast scene. That soon changed. "I wanted to let them know that they couldn't just treat us any kind of way," he said. West Side Connection, formed in the mid-90s. The group included Cube, his South Central childhood friend, Dub C, and Inglewood rapper, Mac 10, the gangsta, the killer, and the dope dealer, as they put it. Their 1996 first single, Bow Down, serves as an anthem of regional pride. "If you live on the west side of your town, make the mother fools bow down," Cube says on the outro. Other tracks on West Side Connection's debut album, Bow Down, were even more inflammatory. On Gangsters Make the World Go Round, Cube raps, "I got enough guns to fill the Empire State Building full of ones." All the critics in New York reflected the group's opinion that West Coast hip-hop wasn't given its due respect by rap writers. Cube wasn't the only one who felt the hip-hop media gave them short shrift, even though the editors of The Source, the reigning title, strenuously denied this. "I was selling millions of records. Cube was selling millions of records. And the rappers who were selling hundreds of thousands were on the front cover," complained Oakland rapper Too Short. But all the critics in New York went way over the top in its invective. "I hope blood ain't got to spill. I kill," Cube raps. "It was a little heavy-handed," Cube admitted. Cube had other beefs around this time, including with Chicago rapper Common Sense, now known as Common. The thoughtful, introspective MC's 1994 album, Resurrection, contains one of hip-hop's most cherished songs, "I Used to Love Her," with H-E-R standing for Hearing Every Rhyme. It's a metaphor for falling out of love with hip-hop, as it becomes increasingly commercialized, and the song reserves criticism for Los Angeles gangster rap styles. "Now she's a gangster rolling with gangster bitches, always smoking blunts and getting drunk, telling me sad stories, now she only fucks with the funk." It's a powerful song, one that summarized many hip-hop fans' concerns about the genre's increasingly aggressive tenor. No one doubted that N.W.A. helped establish this tone, and that its offshoot solo acts were, to varying degrees, perpetuating it. And so even though on the track Common noted that he wasn't salty, she was with the boys in the hood, Cube took offense. On 1995's West Side Slaughterhouse, Mac 10, Cube, and Dub C busted back, dissing Common and claiming hip-hop started in the West, but it didn't amount to much. In the opinion of rap critics, Cube was bodied by Common's response song, The Bitch in You, which took aim at Cube's ideological inconsistencies. "Slanging bean pies and St. Ides in the same sentence," Common rapped. This was at root a lyrical, ideologically driven back and forth. It seemed unlikely that real-life bloodshed might arise from it, considering Common's peace and good vibes reputation. And Cube, of course, has always been a much better public citizen than he's let on. Still, at the height of hip-hop's most violent era, anything seemed possible.
Chapter 23 Potential Leads.
I'm way off my diet right now, Dr. Dre says, grabbing a flaky pastry with custard in the middle.
It's May 2013, and I'm talking to him at a Santa Monica press conference announcing his and Jimmy Iovine's giant donation to the University of Southern California. The $70 million gift created the Jimmy Iovine and Andre Young Academy for Arts, Technology, and the Business of Innovation, basically a multidisciplinary major designed to create tech wonderkinds with music industry cool and engineering smarts. I've wanted to meet Dre since I was in high school, and I'm shaking when we sit down for our interview. Oddly, he seems nervous too, polite but timid, his hands lodged in his pockets. After 3 decades in the business, you'd think he'd be accustomed to this sort of thing. He's not the Dre I expected. Not the Incredible Hulk figure of his recent press photos. Not the cocky hitmaker of Death Row outfitted in diamond-studded Rolexes. And certainly not the mercurial figure with a history of violence. Approaching 50, he looks his age. Trim. Close-cropped hair. Almost no jewelry. There's a gentleness about him. Or maybe it's just, as I'll learn later, his social anxiety. Rather than feeding off the energy of crowds and publicity, Dre generally prefers to stay in his studio or in his mansion.
I don't like being in the spotlight, so I made a fucking weird career choice, he told Rolling Stone in 2015.
He's in a particularly weird place right now. Following The Chronic, Dr. Dre put out Chronic 2001, which was an even bigger hit. The latter album has an odd title, considering its late 1999 release. Dre originally planned to call it Chronic 2000, but the ever-wily Suge beat him to the punch and released a Death Row compilation album with that name, forcing Dre to call his work 2001. He then didn't put out an album for a decade and a half before in 2015, releasing the Straight Outta Compton movie and a surprise album called Compton. It features all original music and isn't really a proper soundtrack to the film, but was rather inspired by it. During the fruitless period, everyone was asking him about Detox, a long-rumored near-mythical album that he finally announced in 2015 he was scrapping. Somewhere along the way, it occurred to him that Detox wasn't going to work. Why? Was Dre tired of playing a gangster? This conflict has, in many ways, become the defining struggle of Dre's life. Born into tough circumstances, he avoided gangs as a kid, and his first group, World Class Wrecking Crew, mocked them. But he found his artistic niche, making music about street life, and he did it so well that it trapped him.
It felt funny going in the studio talking about this bitch and this hoe and how I fucked this girl with a wife at home, Dre said.
Dre tried to retire his bad boy character before, without success. He clearly wants a legacy of standing for something honorable. In addition to the USC gift announced today, he's done a lot for the city of Compton, including donating football uniforms and headphones, and pledging his royalties from his album Compton toward a performing arts center there. Much of his financial success owes to his partnership with Iovine, the man who helped extradite him from the Death Row situation, and with whom, a year after the USC press conference, Dre would sell their headphone business Beats to Apple for $3 billion. It's obvious Dre made a series of brilliant business decisions. To get there, to realize just how fucked up things had gotten under Suge's watch, Dre had to hit rock bottom himself. Night had turned to day in early January 1994, when Dre led police on a high-speed chase through Beverly Hills and Westwood. He was behind the wheel of his white Ferrari Testarossa, a classic 1987 model, popularized by Don Johnson's character in Miami Vice, famous for the side intakes that looked like cheese graters. He was also drunk, reaching speeds of 90 miles per hour, according to the cops.
Next thing I know, I'm surrounded, Dre said, miming police officers pointing their guns at him. Show me your hands. Get out! Get out! Show me your hands!
Like, all right, I'm caught. His blood alcohol level was twice the legal limit. Having violated his probation from punching producer Damon Thomas in 1992, Dre pleaded no contest to DUI. He served about 6 months, beginning in January 1995, although he was allowed to leave the jail during the day to work. It was the culmination of 5 years of self-abuse. After the death of his brother Tyree in 1989, Dre began to drink heavily. He got into fights and was arrested numerous times. With top lawyers at his disposal, Dre was able to minimize the repercussions. But now, with an extended jail stay for the first time in his life, Dre took the time to look in the mirror. While Dre was locked up, it was business as usual at Death Row. The label was spending heavily, including numerous expensive pieces of jewelry. In 1995, downtown jeweler B.L. Diamonds received orders including 18-karat gold Rolex, $35,000, MOB rings, $970 each, 4-karat diamond rings, $35,000, men's diamond bracelets, $10,700, 14-karat yellow gold 4-prong screwback settings diamond earrings, $18,000, gold-plated DuPont lighter, $440, 18-karat yellow gold heart necklace for Suge's mother, $7,600, and more than 1,000 gold pendants for a Mother's Day brunch, $145,000. The orders were facilitated by a Death Row accountant named Steve Cantrock, but eventually the funds ran out. Jeweler Brian Limburger filed suit in 1997 against Death Row, Cantrock, and his accounting firm. Cantrock told police that Suge assaulted him and forced him to sign a hand-drafted confession saying he'd stolen the $4.5 million owed to Death Row's creditors. Suge and Death Row lawyer David Kenner denied the charges, instead blaming Cantrock and his firm for the company's financial woes. Cantrock's firm forced him to resign, and his family went into hiding. Violence, too, continued to surround Death Row. At an after-party for the March 1995 Soul Train Awards at the El Rey Theater, a 28-year-old construction worker named Kelly Jamerson was beaten to death. The party was promoted by Death Row, and many of its artists and affiliates were in attendance. Jamerson, reportedly a Roland 60s Crip, and his cohorts appear to have fought adversaries from the Bloods, who outnumbered them. Despite countless eyewitnesses, criminal charges were never filed. Jamerson's family and its lawyer speculated this was because of Suge's ties to law enforcement. Death Row even began to turn on its own. Rapper and producer Sam Snead was once considered one of the label's brightest stars. His successful 1994 single, You Better Recognize, featured Dr. Dre and was on the Murder Was the Case soundtrack, and he was a featured performer at the 1995 Source Awards. But some at Death Row weren't fans of the You Better Recognize video. They felt Snead, who came from the Pittsburgh area, featured too many East Coast artists without enough representation from Death Row members. Since Dre was on his way out, Tupac and others openly questioned Snead's loyalty.
Are you with us, or are you with Dre?
The day Snoop's murder acquittal was announced, Suge called a meeting at Can-Am. They screened Snead's video, and Tupac grew incensed.
Each time we see an East Coast motherfucker, we gonna knock you in your motherfucking head, he said.
By some accounts, a vicious beating of Snead followed, though Reggie Wright Jr. insisted it mainly consisted of slapping. Later, Suge and others went out to Monty's Steakhouse to celebrate Snoop's verdict. Snead had been pulled into the coastal animosity unwittingly, as was a New York promoter named Mark Anthony Bell, an associate of Puffy's. Bell told police he was intimidated at Death Row's 1995 Christmas party in the Hollywood Hills. According to Bell, Suge demanded the address of Puffy and Puffy's mother and questioned him about the killing of Jake Robles. They sat the dude down in the chair and just started punching him in the grill, wrote Bruce Williams, Dre's assistant, who said he witnessed the beating.
This is for Jake, one of Suge's men said, according to the account Bell gave to police. We're going to kill you.
He said Suge then went to the bathroom and returned with a champagne flute with urine and asked him to drink. Bell said he refused, tried unsuccessfully to escape off a balcony, and was then beaten more and robbed. Again, the district attorney's office declined to press charges, though Bell reportedly received $600,000 in a settlement with Death Row and moved to Jamaica. Suge denied the allegations against him. Dre, now out of jail, and Tupac were both in attendance that night. Bell said Tupac was whispering in Suge's ear, while Williams said he and his boss Dre felt they had walked in on some shit we didn't need to be around. The incident reflected divergent feelings about Death Row's direction. Dre had little patience for this kind of nonsense, while Tupac was consumed by it. Moreover, Tupac took it personally that Dre was distancing himself from Death Row and its ethos.
I'm out here in the streets, whooping niggas' asses, starting wars and shit, putting it down, dropping albums, doing my shit, and this nigga's taking 3 years to do one song,
Tupac complained to journalist Rob Marriott. Tupac castigated Dre for not standing by Snoop at his trial, and even began loudly questioning Dre's sexuality, despite a lack of evidence to support such claims. Tupac's antipathy for Dre was a major turn of events. The opportunity to work with Dre had been a major incentive for Tupac to come to Death Row in the first place. But in the end, the pair, the greatest West Coast producer and the greatest West Coast rapper, barely collaborated.
Tupac never knew me, Dre said. Tupac had never been to my house before. He doesn't even know where I live. We never even been in the same car together.
Princess in a Castle. During his jail sentence, Dre had begun to reassess his priorities.
When I got sentenced, my mom told me that jail was going to turn out to be a blessing in disguise. And she was right, Dre said. It made me realize the value of my life and just how many things I needed to change.
In early 1996, not long after his sentence was completed, Dre stunned the rap world by announcing he'd left Death Row.
It turned into a fucking Don Corleone thing, Dre said. I got tired of seeing engineers get their ass beat for rewinding a tape too far.
Reggie Wright Jr. told me that Suge wanted Dre to stay at Death Row, despite, like Tupac, having loudly criticized him to other label members for not attending Snoop's murder trial. But Suge insisted publicly that he was glad to see Dre go. It helped that Dre gifted his portion of the company away to Suge. His share was worth millions. But Dre walked away from it in favor of something far more valuable to him.
You can't put a price on a peaceful state of mind, he said.
The divorce was nonetheless contested in other ways. Just as he'd allegedly done at Eazy-E's house, Suge reportedly showed up at Dre's Calabasas home, demanding master tapes from Dre that Suge said he needed for a Death Row Greatest Hits album. According to Suge, Dre cowered inside while an off-duty cop answered the door. In Dre's version, Suge was only let past the guards after claiming to be Jimmy Iovine and had 8 or 9 motherfuckers with him. Dre put him off by telling him the tapes were being copied, but it helped perpetuate a feud between the two men that would continue for decades, despite the fact that, only 5 years before, they joined forces to found Death Row. Director S. Lay Savage, who made the documentary Welcome to Death Row, compares the saga surrounding Suge and Dre to Othello. There was Iago, who was in the trenches as a soldier with Othello, and at some point sees the need to usurp him, he said. I always looked at Suge as Iago and Dre as Othello. They were soldiers in arms during that critical period. Perhaps the oddest part about Dre and Shiv's relationship is that they have children with the same woman, former Ruthless Records hitmaker, Michelle A. She and Dre began dating in 1987 and were together on and off until around 1995, after which time she linked up with Suge. She wasn't aware of Dre and Suge's feud until after she became involved with the latter, she said, although according to Reggie Wright Jr., her coupling with Suge contributed to Dre's decision to leave Death Row. As she tells it, Dre's infidelities practically drove her into Suge's arms.
"I felt like you treat people like you want to be treated," Michelle A. told me in 2015.
She added that she was initially scared of Suge, but he won her over by standing up for her. After Dre would cheat on her, and Suge encountered the offending woman at, say, a club or a video shoot, he'd expunge her from the premises, she said. There were hiccups. He and Michelle A. planned to wed, but he neglected to mention he was still married to Sharitha Golden, then known as Sharitha Knight. Michelle A. said he told her he was divorced and even showed her preliminary paperwork. But in fact, the divorce had not yet gone through. He was incarcerated for much of the time they were together, and their daughter was born when he was still behind bars. Michelle A. had very little independence.
"I was a princess in a castle who didn't get to come out that often."
She said that Suge's control caused her to give up singing for many years, and that she attempted suicide around 2013. When Marcel, her son with Dre, was young, she feared he would get caught up in the feud between Dre and Suge, and so to prevent this from happening, she said, she abdicated his care to her mother and her grandmother.
"I didn't connect to my son again, honestly, until he was about 14 or 15, she told me.
In 2002, Michelle A. and Suge had a daughter named Bailey. The two kids get along great.
"People think they should be the Hatfields and McCoys," she said. "No, my kids love each other."
She has long insisted that Suge and Dre are responsible, caring dads.
"They are great fathers, and they are there for them. It's not always monetary. It's about being there."
When we meet up in the lobby of a Koreatown hotel in July 2015, I don't immediately recognize Michelle A. I expected an entourage, but she's alone, and at 44, extraordinarily beautiful. Her manager said our interview would have to be in person because, though she sounds normal on record, her impossibly high, squeaky speaking voice wouldn't translate over the phone. Indeed, she has the register of Betty Boop. We talk about her childhood. Her parents weren't alcoholics or drug addicts and didn't abuse her, she says, but they were never together as a couple and never told her they loved her. Truth is, she can't remember much about her early days.
"I don't know where we lived and what we did because there's no history. My mother just isn't that type of person."
Her memory comes into focus for her in her teen years. At 15, she began dating a local big-shot drug dealer, though he never took her on dates. He'd come over around 11 p.m., they'd watch The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, and then he'd leave.
"But he would give me all this jewelry, necklaces, rings. I had rings on every finger," she said.
Eventually, she realized she wasn't his main girl. It was all part of a pattern. If someone paid lip service to caring about her, she'd tolerate most anything else, she told me. The attraction to Dre and Suge was that they told her they loved her.
"Even after they beat you, or whatever they do."
In the NWA saga, countless women have come and gone. Michelle A's story is different, and not simply because of her relationships with Dre and Suge. She remembers her early days with Ruthless as some of the best of her life. She's a survivor, and in many ways, she won. She can still sing her ass off. She released her second album in 1998 on Death Row called Hung Jury, and her show business career took on a new life in her 40s, starring since 2013
on the reality show R&B Divas, Los Angeles. At the time I interview her, she's arguably as famous as she's ever been. Aftermath. The year 1996 was the major turning point year in Andre Young's life. He married his girlfriend, Nicole Threatt, the ex-wife of Sadale Threatt, a Lakers star who was then winding down a career with five NBA teams. Nicole and Sadale had a boy named Tyler together, whom Dre helped raise as his own. He and Nicole had two more children as well. They married in a small ceremony in front of the ocean at the Four Seasons in Maui. Dre's assistant, Bruce Williams, was shocked to be asked to be Dre's best man, assuming Dre's longtime friend, D.O.C., would get the nod. But they were on the outs, and D.O.C. didn't even attend.
He had grown up, and I hadn't,
D.O.C. explained to me. That same year, 1996, Dre announced the formation of his new label, a subsidiary of Interscope called Aftermath. This kicked off his greatest bromance with Jimmy Iovine, one of the most lucrative in music history. The pair wouldn't seem on paper to have much in common, but Iovine had also transcended his hardscrabble background to a life of wealth and glamour. His ex-wife is a Playboy playmate. If Dre is the god of hip-hop beats, Iovine is the god of the record industry. When, in 2014, Iovine left the merged company known as Interscope Geffen A&M, its roster included Eminem, Madonna, U2, Lady Gaga, and Maroon 5. Billboard called him the most successful head of a major label for the last 25 years. He wasn't just signing artists, he was helping reshape the music industry. Long before Apple's acquisition of Beats, Iovine had worked with Steve Jobs to help convince the major labels to sell their music on iTunes. Though not everyone agrees that unbundling the album to sell tracks a la carte was a good idea, it brought a level of stability to the industry following the Wild West years of the Napster file-sharing era. Initially, success eluded Dre at Aftermath. The label's first release, a compilation album that came out on November 26, 1996, called Dr. Dre Presents The Aftermath, offered evidence of Dre's evolving worldview. The track, Been There, Done That, featured Dre decrying not just black-on-black violence, but gangsta posturing generally. A million motherfuckers on the planet Earth talk that hard bullshit 'cause that's all they're worth. East Coast West Coast Killers enlisted a bipartisan group of MCs, including KRS-One, Nas, and Cypress Hill's Be Real, in an attempt to tamp down coastal animosities. To Dre's chagrin, most of the team he'd assembled at Death Row was off limits, and so he worked to build his roster back up. Though the album sold a million copies, it was considered a misfire.
People were expecting 7-Up, and they got water, Dre later said, adding that his wife Nicole encouraged him to get back on that hardcore shit.
Aftermath's next project was a letdown, too. Supergroup The Firm included New York stalwarts Nas, Foxy Brown, AZ, and Nature, and their 1997 debut work, The Album, features production and rapping from Dr. Dre. In retrospect, it's not such a bad album, but sales were sluggish, and the group shortly disbanded. Aftermath's future seemed in jeopardy, but it was boosted by Detroit white rapper Marshall Mathers, who would soon be known to the world as Eminem. With an innovative flow, Eminem rhymed as an unhinged, psychopathic maniac, mixing pop culture jokes with elaborate stories about killing his daughter's mother. His demo, Slim Shady EP, found its way to Iovine, who shared it with Dre.
When Jimmy played this, I said, find him. Now, Dre recalled in a Rolling Stone interview.
The two began working together, and Eminem would become one of the best-selling pop artists in history.
Dre showed me how to do things with my voice that I didn't know I could do, said Eminem.
By 1999, which saw the multi-platinum releases of Eminem's The Slim Shady LP and Dre's own Chronic 2001, the success of Aftermath was assured. Thriller. If Dre was taking some concerted steps to reshape his life in the first part of 1996, Tupac's was spinning in every direction at once. Much of the public knew him mainly from his problems with the law. And indeed, following his release from prison, he at times seemed to be growing more sinister. He had the word M.O.B. tattooed on his right triceps, for example, though he claimed it stood for money, organization, and business. But he also took steps to repair his image. He sought to unify hip-hop through a project called One Nation, featuring rappers from every part of the country, including Outkast, E-40, and members of Brooklyn Crew, Boot Camp Click. Tupac's mainstream celebrity was developing as well. He made three movies, Bullet, with his friend Mickey Rourke, Gang Related, playing a vice detective, and Gridlocked, with Tim Roth, from Pulp Fiction, on which Tupac was also slated to act as music supervisor for the Death Row-released soundtrack. He planned to include alternative acts including Alanis Morissette and, along with Suge and Snoop, he even talked about opening a restaurant with her. But these projects were just the tip of the iceberg. He was starting a film company, helping organize a youth center, and supporting sports leagues. He even took a girl named Tushana Howard to her prom at John Muir High School. There were changes in his personal life, too. He began a Hollywood-style romance with Kidada Jones, the daughter of music industry royalty Quincy Jones, who produced Thriller. Pursuing her required chutzpah, considering that in 1993 he dissed Quincy in unbelievably derogatory fashion. "All he does is stick his dick in white bitches and make fucked up kids," he told the source in a diatribe about interracial couples. Quincy was furious, and another of his daughters, Rashida, now a famous actress who starred in the TV series Parks and Recreation, wrote an angry letter in reply. Kidada was nonetheless swept off her feet by Tupac, and managed to keep the relationship secret for a time. Then one night, as the pair were dining at an L.A. spot called Jerry's Deli, two hands slammed down on Tupac's shoulders from behind, and there was Dad standing there, Kidada recalled. As he did with everyone, Tupac won him over. He and Kidada soon moved in together, and he told his mother they would be married. Monogamy, however, wasn't in the cards. Women threw themselves at him in Milan, where he visited for Men's Fashion Week in 1996. He walked a runway and was feted by top designers. Though he wasn't too thrilled to receive a European-style kiss from Gianni Versace. In any case, he bedded numerous women, wrote his bodyguard Frank Alexander, somehow working around the fact that he was sharing a hotel room with Kidada. Suge said he and Tupac had an inseparable bond until the end, but some contend the rapper was growing disillusioned with his label. "We thought he was trying to get off of Death Row. That's why he did those albums so fast," said Nate Dogg, referencing Tupac's recording spree that continued into 1996 and which informed his voluminous posthumous output. Tupac plotted his own imprint, Machiavelli Records, whose artists would have included The Outlaws and female rapper Storm. It's unclear if he intended it to be a Death Row subsidiary. "Pac was a loyal dude. Even if he was planning on getting off Death Row, I'm sure they would still be doing some business together," said Outlaws rapper Young Noble, adding that Tupac remained grateful to Suge for his prison rescue. Suge was blunt on the matter to MTV. "If you'd asked Tupac that question, was he planning on leaving Death Row? He definitely would have cussed you out." Tupac was upset with lawyer David Kenner, however, who had abandoned most of the rest of his practice to focus on Death Row. Kenner's role went much farther than that of a traditional lawyer. According to the memoir written by Suge's girlfriend Stormy Ramdan, Kenner was responsible for everything from paternity issues to hiring nannies. Kenner did not respond to her request for comment. Tupac enlisted an additional lawyer, named Charles Ogletree, who later told the New Yorker that Death Row had stymied his client's attempts to negotiate a more formal contract to replace the memo Tupac signed in prison. Eventually, according to Ogletree, Tupac began to plan his escape. He had a strategy. The idea was to maintain a friendly relationship with Suge, but to separate his business. In the summer of 1996, Tupac took the drastic step of firing Kenner, which shocked those at Death Row who learned about it. Tupac's behavior was similarly brazen when it came to his ongoing feuds with New York rappers. Following the MTV Video Music Awards in Manhattan on September 4, 1996, he talked up plans for Death Row East and dubiously bragged that, "We already run the streets out here." He trash-talked Queens rapper Nas, who he believed appropriated his style, though the pair reconciled shortly thereafter. When an MTV interviewer asked him about Biggie and Puffy, also in attendance at the awards, Tupac went on a gleeful, passive-aggressive rant, mocking Bad Boy's album sales and noting that though his camp were businessmen not looking for trouble, "If they see us and they want drama, we're definitely going to bring it like only Death Row can bring it." Still, he finished with a plea that MTV exercise restraint in playing up the East Coast-West Coast beef and gave himself the same responsibility. Mob Style. Mike Tyson didn't know Tupac when they met outside a nightclub in the early 90s, but when the fledgling rapper was stopped at the door, even though he was scheduled to perform, the champion boxer intervened. A friendship developed, but they didn't get much opportunity to hang out, considering they both spent so much time in prison. Tyson's biggest regret was that he declined Tupac's offer to get him high. Following Tyson's release in early 1995, after serving 3 years for the rape of Desiree Washington, he undertook a series of comeback fights. He won the first three easily, and was the favorite going into his bout against heavyweight title holder Bruce Seldon at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas on September 7, 1996. Promoted by Don King, the fight drew a large pay-per-view audience and a frenzied crowd, who heard Tupac's new song, "Let's Get It On," at full volume over the speakers as Tyson was led into the ring. Rappers have a long history of providing motivational tracks for their favored boxers, and Tupac's track touted Tyson's ferociousness and laid out the plans for the evening. "This ain't gonna last long. Y'all know how Tyson do it. We gonna watch him beat this boy silly, and then we gonna all go party at 6-6 Deuce, mob style." From the front row, Tupac and Suge saw Tyson wallop Seldon in under 2 minutes. Tyson gave them a hug, and they said goodbye in his dressing room, planning to meet up later. Adrenalized, Tupac threw shadow punches as they exited the event.
50 blows! I counted them,"
he told his bodyguard Frank Alexander. Outside the arena in the MGM, they met some of Suge's guys, including a blood named Trayvon Trey Lane, who had some troubling news. He'd just spotted a guy in the hotel who'd snatched his Death Row chain during a recent altercation at the Lakewood Mall, not far from Compton. The guy in question was Orlando Anderson. Not only was he a Southside Crip, but according to a sheriff's deputy, he was on the scene in Atlanta when Suge's bodyguard Jake Robles was murdered there a year prior. At Trey's news, Tupac took off running. He quickly caught up with Anderson.
"You from the South?" he asked.
Before Anderson could respond, Tupac punched him. The Death Row crew piled on. Suge and his associates kicked and stomped Anderson as MGM security cameras rolled. Security intervened, and the Death Row contingent hustled toward the doors. As they wound their way through the casino toward the exit, people began to recognize Tupac, streaming out from behind slot machines and trailing behind him in mass like the Pied Piper. As they departed the scene, Tupac boasted of his fighting skills.
I took him off faster than Tyson, he said,
according to his bodyguard Frank Alexander. For Alexander, a genial former bodybuilder, the death row detail was growing increasingly stressful. For starters, they were shorthanded on this trip. They were missing three bodyguards, including Tupac's other main security, Kevin Hackey. Further, Alexander had neither his phone nor his gun. He'd left his firearm behind, he said, because he believed Death Row hadn't gotten the proper clearance from local authorities in advance. Death Row's head of security, Reggie Wright Jr., disputed this in an interview with me, however.
He could have and should have had his gun, Wright said.
Tupac made it back to his hotel, the Luxor, where he changed clothes and chatted with Kadada. The plan was to head over to Knights Club 662, where Run-DMC and Craig Mack were scheduled to perform. Tupac and company were hoping to use the opportunity to recruit Run-DMC to Death Row East. Tupac decided Kadada shouldn't attend, however.
I'm not taking you, he said. There's been a fight with a Crip, and it's not safe. So you stay here.
Their caravan to the club included about a half a dozen vehicles, filled with a formidable lineup of security guards, Outlaws members, and Bloods enforcers. But Tupac opted to ride alone with Suge in the latter's new BMW 750iL. As they drove, they blasted music from the new album Tupac was working on called The Don Killuminati, The 7-Day Theory. The BMW was stopped by a police officer who gave Suge a warning for not properly displaying plates, but they were quickly back on their way, and the celebratory mood continued. With the BMW's windows open, a car of female Tupac fans recognized him and began screaming. He encouraged them to join the caravan. As the BMW approached the intersection of Flamingo and Koval, in front of the Maxim Hotel, a white Cadillac going in the opposite direction did a U-turn and pulled up next to them. An arm holding a .40 caliber Glock extended out the window and began firing into the BMW. Tupac attempted to scramble out of the way and into the back seat.
I grabbed him and said, get out! And covered him, Suge said.
A dozen shots or so were fired, and Tupac was hit 4 times. One of the bullets ricocheted off his hip bone, deflecting into his lung. Suge was grazed, likely from a bullet fragment or piece of flying debris from the shot-up car.
He said, I'm hit,
Suge recalled in an interview with BET's Stephanie Frederick.
So I'm driving like a madman to the hospital. And he said laughingly, jokingly, loudly, I need a hospital. You're the one that's been shot in the head.
A car containing Suge's enforcers chased after the white Cadillac, exchanging gunfire, but the shooter managed to escape. Driving off wildly, Suge's car didn't make it to the hospital, instead colliding with a curb and blowing out its tires. The cops seized Suge, who was bleeding from his head, putting him spread-eagle on the ground. Other members of the party were splayed onto the concrete, shotguns pointed at their heads, including Idi Amin, who said cops asked for their gang affiliations and the meanings of their tattoos. An ambulance arrived to take Tupac, bloody but still conscious, to University Medical Center Hospital. Waiting for his return at her Luxor suite, Kidada Jones was lying down to sleep when she received the call that Tupac had been shot. She rushed to the hospital.
When I got to the hospital, they handed me a bag of bloody clothes and jewelry and told me he had no blood pressure when he came in, she wrote. He's had 2 blood transfusions and is in the ICU hanging by a string.
He fought for 6 days, undergoing surgeries, including the removal of his right lung. Police and Fruit of Islam guards stood alert at the trauma unit doors.
Motherfuckers was calling the hospital making threats, said young Noble.
He and fellow Outlaws member Napoleon had stayed behind in L.A. but after learning Tupac was shot, soon arrived in Vegas, pistols in tow. Tupac's allies organized their own security detail, and the crew, which included members of the Outlaws, took shifts standing watch, armed and prepared for anything.
"We was pretty much all ready to die at that point," said young Noble.
News cameras crowded entryways, and fans drove by blasting Tupac music. Jasmine Guy, Hammer, and Jesse Jackson visited, while Danny Boy sat at his bedside and sang him one of his favorite songs, Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. On September 13th, Tupac's mother, Rafaini, told doctors not to continue their efforts to resuscitate him.
"Tupac would not have wanted to live as an invalid," she told the New Yorker.
It was like a spaceship had beamed down, snatched him, and took him away, wrote Frank Alexander. It was that fast. Smoke My Ashes. Tupac's body was cremated. His family held a private service in Las Vegas the day after his death, and thousands of fans flocked to public memorials for him in New York and Atlanta. A planned death row service for Tupac in L.A. was canceled, fueling conspiracy theories that he's still alive. Even Suge in 2014 insisted to TMZ that the rapper was
smoking a Cuban cigar on an island somewhere.
Meanwhile, having taken over Tupac's estate, Afeni faced court battles on many fronts. She fought off a claim to half of the estate from Tupac's father, and she sued Death Row for $50 million in unpaid royalties. Tupac had very little to his name when he died, as some of his cars and his apartment were in Death Row's name. The label claimed Tupac owed them money, $7.1 million for advances and loans. The suit was ultimately settled for undisclosed terms. Then there was activist C. Dolores Tucker, who sued the estate for $10 million, alleging in part that Tupac lyrics caused her emotional distress, and thus her husband was left without companionship and consortium. The twin burden of mourning her son while battling in court took its toll on Afeni, who died herself in May 2016. She was most moved to hear, "Dear Mama,
can I listen to it without crying?" she said in a 1997 People interview. "No, it gets worse every time. It gets harder. It really does. That song gets deeper and deeper."
Some of Tupac's ashes were spread in the ocean. The Outlaws bonded with his spirit in their own ways, taking his lyric from his posthumous song, Black Jesus, at its word.
"Cremated last wishes, niggas smoke my ashes. We twist up some of that great granddaddy Cali Kush, sprinkle some of the big homie in there, and guess what?" young Noble said. "He's in our system for eternity."
Afeni sprinkled another portion of her son's ashes in her Stone Mountain, Georgia home's garden, making her eggplants and tomatoes go crazy. Owing to his participation in the beating of Orlando Anderson at the MGM, Suge Knight was cited for a parole violation and sentenced to 9 years in prison. Death Row continued in his absence, led by figureheads including Reggie Wright Jr. Still, Suge was always kind of running the show, said their freelance publicist, Jonathan Wolfson. Though temporarily buoyed by posthumous Tupac albums, the label's fortunes diminished in the years that followed. A federal racketeering probe against Death Row spurred misdemeanor tax charges against the label and David Kenner. Death Row and Knight filed for bankruptcy in 2006, with items like the label's iconic electric chair eventually sold at auction. Though difficult to feel much sympathy for Suge, it's nonetheless dispiriting to consider Death Row's fall, and how its spoils were ultimately divided up. The white co-founders of Interscope, Jimmy Iovine and Ted Field, made countless millions. Tupac was left dead, and Suge and Dre came away with virtually nothing. Death Row's other two initial founders, Dick Griffey and DLC, had to sue to get their pennies, noted Griffey. Tupac's first posthumous album, The Don